And welcome back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority on CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto, or one of our wonderful syndicates across the country. We're going to go now to an interview I recorded earlier this week. This is with Chelsea Gutzman with Alternatives Journal, and she takes a rather interesting and unique perspective on the Northern Gateway Pipeline Project from the point of view of ecotourism and the effect on locals in BC. Go away. So I'm speaking to Chelsea Gutzman. She was submitted an article to our good friends over at Alternative Journal talking about Northern Gateway, and I've got her on the line now who's apparently calling me from the middle of a marsh. Welcome to the Green Majority, Chelsea.
Thank you. I'm actually in the middle of Castalia Marsh Resort on Grand Manan Island, so it's great to be talking to you.
And so, tell us a little bit about, we were talking before and you said you're not the most obvious environmentalist. You're coming at this more of a journalist, I guess, if anything. Do you want to just mention a little bit how you got onto this topic at all before we get into the nitty gritty of your article?
Sure. So I applied to work at Alternatives Journal just because I was interested in environmental issues, never having studied them before. And they accepted me for a work term, which was great. So I was working there for four months full time. And Eric, the editor there, just really believed in me and had this idea for this article that he really wanted to get done. And so he gave it to me, and I was a little hesitant at first, but I really got into it. You know, I was working on it for a good couple months, so I'm really happy with it.
Okay, and the outline of the article itself, we're talking about the Northern Gateway Pipeline. Obviously, that's been a big environmental issue in Canada for a while. Lots of government sources and others very excited about it, and pretty much unanimously every environmentalist pulling their hair out about it. So, but you took the angle of talking to some ecotourism locales here. So we've got four owners, and then one more owner of a, was it a resort or something, who basically said, I support the pipeline, but I refuse any further comment.
Yeah, it was actually a rafting company, but yeah.
So basically, I mean, the total article here was we're talking about the pipeline and talking about the effects, but what I thought was really interesting about the story, because we've covered this issue, I mean, a dozen times or more, was just the perspective of kind of local businesses on the ground that are going to be affected by this. So why don't you just take us through a little bit some of the different people that you spoke to and some of the items that they had to say. Why don't we start with the King Pacific Lodge?
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I spoke to Michael Uehara. He was the first person that I actually spoke with, and he has obviously been very involved in the debate, and he knows a lot about what's going on in that territory. He's been there for, I don't even remember, but a good number of years, and so he knows a lot about the whales, like the migration routes of the whales and the feeding areas of the whales, and he really knew a lot about how the tankers might affect the whales and other sea life. So that's what I talked to him mostly about. But yeah, he thinks that with super tankers going through there like twice a day, it's just really going to destroy the business and really destroy the pristine environment.
Have you seen this area?
Yeah, Hartley Bay. No, I haven't personally seen it myself. I've Pacific Wild, Ian McAllister, who I spoke with, has been making a lot of really great documentaries about the area, so that's kind of where I know the area from. But yeah, I'd love to go there at some point before it gets, you know, ruined.
And so, I mean, we'll keep going with some of the other lodges and stuff. But I'm sort of getting the sense from you already that you think this is a moot point potentially.
I just think the whole pipeline and the whole tankers going through the tanker traffic, I just think that it's a huge mistake. And I think, you know, in 50 years, if this were to go through, we're going to look back on it and we're going to look at it as one of the largest mistakes we've ever made.
Wow. And so was this the tone generally, like when you're speaking to Michael, for instance, was this the viewpoint that generally the people you were speaking to felt as well? They sort of reluctantly had to admit that the more than likely they weren't going to be able to stop the project.
I don't know. There's a lot of kind of grassroots kind of opposition to the pipeline. So people are thinking that this joint review panel process is kind of a waste of time. That was kind of the feeling that I was getting from a lot of the people I was speaking with. But everyone seems to agree that, you know, even if this does get pushed through, everyone's going to be there on the ground, you know, physically with blockades and things, because this is so important to so many people living out there.
One of the other perspectives, obviously, on this, aside from small business and the environmental community, is, of course, the First Nations community. One of the other owners, Marvin Robson, I'm not sure I know how to pronounce that, but the Gitgatak Spirit Tours?
The Gitgat Spirit Tours, yeah.
Spirit Tours. Yeah. And so that kind of adds like another layer of perspective. Do you want to talk a little bit about their point of view on what exactly the impact here and their concerns were?
Mm-hmm. Well, when I first spoke with him, I was first asking him about how he thinks it's going to affect, you know, his tourism and the people coming in and, like, his well-being as far as, like, tourism income goes. And he just really was not concerned about that at all. You know, being a member of First Nations right there on the tanker route, he is just really more concerned about his community and about their food source and about, you know, the bears and the wolves and the fish and the kelp and everything there that really sustains the whole area. So he really could not stress enough how little it meant to him that he would be losing tourism dollars, and just how much it meant to him that it meant that possibly the whole community, you know, if there were to be a spill, the whole community would probably just have to move.
Yeah. I mean, he was saying in the, you were saying that he was identified in the article that they had a biologist that had been doing work on some of the tides and currents and talking about the, just the food chain there, about how, so like smaller fish feeding the herring, I think he was saying, feeding the salmon, and that feeds all the bears and when eventually gets up to, you know, feeding whales and this sort of thing. So, I mean, the impact here that seems to be that he's sort of identifying is that this could sort of, you know, like desertify as far as from a wildlife perspective anyway, the whole region.
Exactly. It's a really special area in terms of the herring being able to, you know, populate there. And without the herring, I mean, without the herring, there's no salmon. And without the salmon, there's no bears, no wolves. Like, it could potentially just totally devastate the entire area were we to lose that herring population.
Well, and the you know, BC salmon approached and marketed and has a similar impact, although not quite as vital, not as such a linchpin, but very reminiscent of the kind of cod on the East Coast as well. But are you aware of it all? Any concern one way or the other as far as how the BC provincial government feels about this? I mean, one would think that they'd be terribly concerned about what would otherwise be their largest kind of identifying trades.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, as far as I can tell, they don't seem to be very much concerned at all. I mean, with the whole Cohen Commission thing that just happened, I mean, they're obviously not very concerned about the salmon populations or protecting them at all, as far as I can see, and I think that's a huge mistake. I think that they're being very short-sighted.
So move on to Castan Outdoor Adventure Tourism. Kayla Pollard was the person that you spoke to there, and this is the one, I believe, where they do like horse rides and stuff like that, and like tours. There's been mostly tourism that they do. And they had identified some concern and pointed out some details that I thought were very interesting about how a lot of the intersections there is all going to be controlled by automated computer systems, and there's not live people on the ground kind of anywhere even nearby, specifically pointing out that if it happened during the winter months, that they wouldn't be able to clean it up at all potentially, and during the summer, even then, it would still take people several days to even get on the ground assessing the spill. I mean, this sort of details that, you know, we start thinking about Deepwater Horizon and stuff like that, and be like, is no one paying attention to how badly this goes? It seems like no one's learning from their mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
it's just so isolated. Like, Fort St. James is one of the only towns even up there, so were there to be a spill like anywhere outside of, like, directly in Fort St. James, like, potentially they could not discover the spill for, well, you know, the Kalamazoo River spill they didn't discover for 17 days or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, something like that could just ruin the whole water system. Like, it could get into Stewart Lake and it would just totally devastate the entire area, and they wouldn't even be able to get in potentially to clean it up. Some of the places that they're putting this pipeline through are just so remote. There's just no roads, no access at all. And in the winter, if it was stormy or anything like that, like, I could see the spill potentially going on for weeks.
Do you know at all, is it within what you've looked at or what you've learned about at all from any of the interviews that you did, as far as like what plans, if any, that Enbridge is saying that they would have in such a case? I mean, is their assertion simply there will not be a spill, so don't worry about it, or?
Well, they do have some plans in place. I say that kind of loosely. When Kyla Pollard, she's really involved in the joint review panel process, and she's an intervener, and a lot of people in Fort St. James are. And when she was asking for information about their plans and everything like that for if there were potentially to be a spill, like, she found that they didn't really provide any specific information at all. Like, they had no plans for a specific, you know, location that would be closest for them to get to the spill. Like, they had no specifics at all. It was all very general and, you know, not particularly helpful at all.
It reminds me, again, kind of going back to the Deepwater Horizon issue from a couple years ago, where they said, we're confident that we can, and then they said kind of under their breath, confront 90% of the oil. And it's like, so what does that exactly mean? Is it, what appears to literally mean in that case when they were saying with relation to building, you know, moving Arctic drilling and stuff like that and moving oil through the Arctic, was that, well, we'll go out in a boat and we'll point at, we'll be able to physically see with our own eyes that at least 90% of the oil. Seem to be the response, and I'm getting sort of a very similar sort of thing here about is just don't worry about it, it'll be fine. Cough.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, am I being too sarcastic here, or is that really, like, is there really not any information that's been passed on about security and safety measures and that sort of thing?
Well, as of when I last looked at all of the, like, all of the papers and all of the information that has been submitted to the Joint Review Panel, which, by the way, is just absolutely overwhelming, and I think that that is kind of the point, so that normal citizens can't even really sift through it at all. But like, the last time I looked, there were no specifics at all. And as far as everyone who I've spoken to, they have not been given any specifics at all. And like, they're not even dealing, is the thing, they're not even dealing with oil. Like, they're dealing with diluted bitumen. And there haven't been any tests at all to see how diluted bitumen would react differently if it were spilled into water. Like, they're just operating under the assumption that this mixture is going to be acting the same as oil, but that there's been no studies and no confirmation of that whatsoever. And a lot of people are speculating that the condensate that it's going to be diluted with is just going to evaporate, and the bitumen is just going to sink so much quicker than normal oil, and it's just going to be impossible to clean up from the waterways.
I mean, we've been speaking quite a bit on the last couple of weeks about C-38 and about changing of environmental assessment rules, and just seems like that's the kind of tone right now, is proceed at any cost. And it sounds like that's definitely the impression that you got from the people that you were speaking to, and from what you've looked into as well here, is that there doesn't at least appear to have been too much even investigating. It's not even that, you know, they're hiding the information or something. It's that it doesn't even seem anyone's looked into it, and they're just kind of, oh, whatever, it'll be fine.
Exactly.
Is that the sort of impression that you've been getting?
Yes, exactly. Like, it seems like they are just assuming that this pipeline is just going to be just like any other pipeline, but it's really not. Just the area it's going through, the products that are going to be traveling through it, it's just a totally different ball game than anything they've done before. And they're just not doing the proper studies and the proper environmental assessments, and it just hasn't been done, and they just really have no clue.
Well, and I mean, it's to say that, you know, to assume that this is like any other pipeline, also sort of, you know, as a reminder, even regular pipelines aren't really that safe. Anyway, I mean, we have spills all the time, and, you know, without even getting into the complicated issue of people intentionally disrupting, you know, pipelines through mm-hmm. protest or terrorism or whatever it is that you want to call it. I mean, there's so many things that can happen, and so, I mean, you can't even really say that a regular pipeline is that safe, and this seems potentially much worse. I mean, we can't know for sure, but this is an area where you'd think you'd want at least some level of certainty or some, you know, safety bars, because we've got, you know, basically from what you're describing, it sounds like basically an untested situation in an extreme condition for that untested situation, no matter where it was, and in a particularly sensitive place if something does go wrong. I mean, it's from the way that you're describing it, and from what I've read elsewhere as well, I mean, it really sounds like playing with fire.
Precisely.
So there was one other owner that you interviewed as well, which is Timberwood Tours, and they said that part of their outlook as well is dealing a lot with kind of passing on stewardship, and their concern, a lot of it had to do with the fact that people from international tourism and stuff like that are losing interest in coming and looking at Canada, because like, why would we want to come and look at your pipeline?
Yeah, exactly. Like, when I was speaking with Mike, he was just mostly concerned about, because he gets a lot of tourists coming from France, Germany, and England and places like that, and he was just mostly concerned that people are just not wanting to come to Canada anymore because of, you know, because of the Harper government, the decisions they've been making, and, well, it goes back further than that, really, but it's just because that everyone used to think of Canada as a pristine place. And it's just really, with the whole tar sands thing that's been going on, it's just really looking to other countries like we have lost that. Like, we have lost that sense of nature, and we've lost that sense of trying to protect our environment. And people just are not really wanting to come in as large numbers as they used to. And I was actually looking at a lot of tourism numbers. I was trying to get a chart into the article that I didn't end up getting in. But just the tourism rates, just from every other country, mm-hmm. just coming to Alberta and BC, like, they have just been declining over the past 10 years, like, almost unanimously, like, almost across the board.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so the final quote from Mike as well was at the end was, why not invest all this energy and oil into finding alternatives for oil rather than digging up more? I don't suppose you have an answer to that question.
Why not? Money is the answer to that question, you know. It's just, like, I really can't wrap my head around it. Like, I've spent a lot of sleepless nights just worrying about this, because it's something that is really important to a lot of Canadians, but is not important to our government that we elected. And I don't want to get too political or too passionate about it, so I'll leave it at that.
Well, I think it would be appropriate to say as well, I mean, it's one of those situations where, I mean, you know, we've covered 100 projects, over 100 projects on the Green Majority about different this and this and that, and there's you know, always somebody who's concerned about the local impacts, and we'll go and we'll talk to them. And you know what, sometimes, you know, it is a dangerous project and you know, nothing happens, or there is no, you know, super immediate effects, or we haven't noticed anything yet, but maybe it'll happen in the future. But the point, you know, isn't that every time something goes wrong, it's that, you know, calculating risk. And it just seems like, to me at least, from you know, reading through news articles every week, that the amount of risk that the government and corporations are willing to take, because I guess because they feel like it's on the public's back if anything goes wrong, just seems to be, like, the amount of risk they're willing to accept seems to be increasing over time.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just like Christy Clark, Premier of BC, was saying, like, she doesn't think that the risk is worth the economic benefits, at least for BC. And everyone else that I was speaking to seems to think that money is just not an issue. You know, like, the Harper government keeps trying to buy off, you know, these groups, and thinking that eventually, like, people are going to come to their senses, per se, because of the jobs and the economic impact. But the thing is, it's not about money if we're not going to have a BC coast to pass on, you know, to our children. It's more important that we're able to pass on the land, you know, the BC coast and everything, than it is for any potential economic benefits that we could possibly get, because the risk is just way too high. Like, for the next 50 or 100 or even 300 years, our whole coast, or specific rivers, or, you know, the whole spirit bear population or whatever, can be totally wiped out, and that's really not worth anything. The joint review panel is going to be assessing until April, and then they're going to be presenting their findings, yeah, by the end of next year. So by the end of 2013, we're going to hopefully find out what the status of this project is, and hopefully it will be that it is not going through.
All right. That was Chelsea Gutsman from Alternatives Journal talking about the Northern Gateway Pipeline from the perspective of ecotourism locales in local BC, where she is currently right now enjoying a vacation in the middle of a swamp, I understand.